This is Audible.
Recorded Books and RB Digital present The Silent Corner, a novel of suspense by Dean Koontz. Narrated by Elizabeth Rogers. The Silent Corner. Those who are truly off the grid and cannot be tracked by any technology, yet are able to move about freely and use the internet, are said to be in the silent corner. Part 1. Rock Me. Chapter 1. Jane Hawke woke in the cool dark, and for a moment could not remember where she had gone to sleep, only that, as always, she was in a queen or king-size bed, and that her pistol lay under the pillow on which the head of a companion would have rested had she not been traveling alone. Diesel growl and friction drone of 18 tires on asphalt reminded her that she was in a motel near the interstate, and it was Monday. With a soft green numerical glow, the bedside clock reported the bad but not uncommon news that it was 4:15 in the morning. Too early for her to have gotten 8 hours of sack time, too late to imagine that she might fall back to sleep. She lay for a while, thinking about what had been lost. She had promised herself to stop dwelling on the bitter past. She spent less time on it now than before, which would have counted as progress if recently she hadn't turned to thoughts of what was yet to be lost. She took a change of clothes and the pistol into the bathroom. She shut the door and braced it with a straight-backed chair that she had moved from the bedroom upon checking in the previous night. Such was the maid service that in the corner above the sink, the radials and spirals of a spider's architecture extended across an area larger than her hand. When she had gone to bed at 11 o'clock, the only provision hanging in the web had been a struggling moth. During the night, the moth had become but the husk of a moth, the hollow body translucent, the wings shorn of their velvet dust, brittle and fractured. The plump spider now watched over a pair of captured silverfish, leaner fare, though another morsel would soon find its way into the gossamer abattoir. Outside, the light from a security lamp gilded the frosted glass in the small crank-out bathroom window, which was not large enough to allow even a child to gain entrance. Its dimensions would also preclude her from escaping through it in a crisis. Jane put the pistol on the closed lid of the toilet and left the vinyl curtain open while she took a shower. The water was hotter than she expected from a 2-star operation, melting accumulated soreness out of muscle and bone. But she didn't linger in the spray as long as she would have liked. Chapter 2. Her shoulder rig featured a holster with swivel connectors, a spare magazine carrier, and a suede harness. The weapon hung just behind her left arm, a deep position that allowed unparalleled concealment beneath her specially tailored sport coats. In addition to the spare magazine clipped to the rig, she kept 2 others in the pockets of the jacket, a total of 40 rounds, counting those in the pistol. The day might come when 40 was not enough. She had no backup anymore, no team in a van around the corner if everything went to shit. Those days were over, for the time being, if not forever. She couldn't arm herself for infinite combat. In any situation, if 40 rounds proved not enough, neither would 80 or 800. She did not delude herself regarding her skills or endurance. She carried her 2 suitcases out to the Ford Escape, raised the tailgate, loaded the bags, and locked the vehicle. The sun that had not yet risen must have been producing a solar flare or two. The bright silver moon declining in the west reflected so much light that the shadows of its craters had blurred away. It looked not like a solid object, but instead like a hole in the night sky, pure and dangerous light shining through from another universe. In the motel office, she returned the room key. Behind the front desk, a guy with a shaved head and a chin beard asked if everything had been to her satisfaction, almost as if he genuinely cared. She nearly said, "With all the bugs, I imagine a lot of your guests are entomologists," but she didn't want to leave him with a more memorable image of her than the one he got from picturing her naked. She said, "Yeah, fine," and walked out of there. At check-in, she had paid cash in advance and used one of her counterfeit driver's licenses to provide the required ID, according to which Lucy Ames of Sacramento had just left the building. Early spring flying beetles of some kind clicked in the metal cones of the lamps mounted to the ceiling of the covered walkway, and their exaggerated spriggy-legged shadows jigged on the spotlit concrete underfoot. As she walked to the diner next door, which was part of the motel operation, she was aware of the security cameras but didn't look directly at any of them. Surveillance had become inescapable. The only cameras that could undo her, however, were those in airports, train stations, and other key facilities that were linked to computers running real-time, state-of-the-art facial recognition software. Her flying days were over. She went everywhere by car. When all this started, she'd been a natural blonde with long hair. Now, she was a brunette with a shorter cut. Changes of that kind could not foil facial recognition if you were being hunted. Short of spackling herself with an obvious disguise that would also draw unwanted attention, she could not have done much to change the shape of her face or the many unique details of her features to escape this mechanized detection. Chapter 3. A three-egg cheese omelet, a double rasher of bacon, sausage, extra butter for the toast, hold the home fries, coffee instead of orange juice. She thrived on protein, but too many carbs made her feel sluggish and slow-witted. She didn't worry about fat, because she'd have to live another 2 decades to develop arteriosclerosis. The waitress brought refill coffee. She was 30-ish. Pretty in a faded flower way, too pale and too thin, as if life whittled and bleached her day by day.
"You hear about Philadelphia?"
"What now?"
"Some crazies crashed this private jet plane straight into 4 lanes of bumper-to-bumper morning traffic. TV says there must have been a full load of fuel. Almost a mile of highway on fire. This bridge collapsed totally, cars and trucks blowing up. Those poor people trapped in it? Horrible. We got a TV in the kitchen. It's too awful to look. Makes you sick to watch it. They say they do it for God, but it's the devil in them. What are we ever gonna do?"
"I don't know," Jane said.
"I don't think anybody knows."
"I don't think so either." The waitress returned to the kitchen, and Jane finished eating breakfast. "If you let the news spoil your appetite, there wouldn't be a day you could eat." Chapter 4. The black Ford Escape appeared to be Detroit light, but this one had secrets under the hood and the power to outrun anything with the words "to serve and protect" on its front doors. 2 weeks earlier, Jane had paid cash for the Ford in Nogales, Arizona, which was directly across the international border from Nogales, Mexico. The car had been stolen in the United States, given new engine block numbers and more horsepower in Mexico, and returned to the States for sale. The dealer's showrooms were a series of barns on a former horse ranch. He never advertised his inventory, never issued a receipt, or paid taxes. Upon request, he provided Canadian license plates and a guaranteed legitimate registration card from the Department of Motor Vehicles for the province of British Columbia. When dawn came, she was still in Arizona, racing westward on Interstate 8. The night paled. As the sun slowly cleared the horizon in her wake, the high, feathery cirrus clouds ahead of her pinked before darkening to coralline, and the sky waxed through shades of increasingly intense blue. Sometimes, on long drives, she wanted music. Bach, Beethoven, Brahms, Mozart, Chopin, Liszt. This morning, she preferred silence. In her current mood, even the best of music would sound discordant. 40 miles past sunrise, she crossed the state line into southernmost California. During the following hour, the high white fleecy clouds lowered and congested and grayed into wool pack. After another hour, the sky had grown darker, swollen, malign. Near the western periphery of the Cleveland National Forest, she exited the interstate at the town of Alpine, where General Gordon Lambert had lived with his wife. The previous evening, Jane had consulted one of her old but useful Thomas guides, a spiral-bound book of maps. She was sure she knew how to find the house. In addition to other modifications made to the Ford Escape in Mexico, the entire GPS had been removed, including the transponder that allowed its position to be tracked continuously by satellite and other means. There was no point in being off the grid if the vehicle you drove was Wi-Fi'd to it with every turn of the wheels. Although rain was as natural as sunshine, although nature functioned without intentions, Jane saw malice in the coming storm. Lately, her love of the natural world had at times been tested by a perception, perhaps irrational but deeply felt, that nature was colluding with humanity in enterprises wicked and destructive. Chapter 5. 14,000 souls lived in Alpine, a percentage of them sure to believe in fate. Fewer than 300 were from the Viejas band of Kumeyaay Indians, who operated the Viejas Casino. Jane had no interest in games of chance. Minute by minute, life was a continuous rolling of the dice, and that was as much gambling as she could handle. Graced with pines and live oaks, the central business district was frontier town quaint. Certain buildings actually dated to the Old West, but others, of more recent construction, aped that style with varying degrees of success. The number of antiques stores, galleries, gift shops, and restaurants suggested year-round tourism that predated the casino. San Diego, the 8th largest city in the country, was less than 30 miles and 1,800 feet of elevation away. Wherever at least 1 million people lived in close proximity to one another, a significant portion needed, on any given day, to flee the hive for a place of less busy buzzing. The white-clabbered, black-shuttered Lambert residence stood on the farther outskirts of Alpine, on approximately half an acre of land. The front yard picket-fenced, the porch furnished with wicker chairs. The flag was at full mast on a pole at the northeast corner of the house, the red and white fly billowing gently in the breeze, the 50-star canton pulled taut in full display against the curdled, brooding sky. The 25-mile-per-hour speed limit allowed Jane to cruise past slowly without appearing to be canvassing the place. She saw nothing out of the ordinary. But if they suspected that she might come here because of the bond she shared with Gwyneth Lambert, they would be circumspect almost to the point of invisibility. She passed 4 other houses before the street came to a dead end. There, she turned and parked the Escape on the shoulder of the lane, facing back the way she had come. These homes stood on the brow of a hill with a view of El Capitan Lake. Jane followed a dirt path down through an open woods and then along a treeless slope, green with maiden grass that would be as gold as wheat by midsummer. At the shore, she walked south, surveying the lake, which looked both placid and disarranged because the rumpled laundry clouds were reflected in the serene, mirrored surface. She gave equal attention to the houses on her left, gazing up as if admiring each. Fences indicated that the properties occupied only the scalped flat lots at the top of the hill. The white pickets at the front of the Lambert house were repeated all the way around. She walked behind two more residences before returning to the Lambert place and climbing the slope. The back gate featured a simple gravity latch. Closing the gate behind her, she considered the windows, from which the draperies had been drawn aside and the blinds raised to admit as much of the day's dreary light as possible. She could see no one gazing out at the lake, or on the watch for her. Committed now, she followed the pickets around the side of the house. As the clouds lowered and the flag rustled in a breeze that smelled faintly of either the rain to come or the waters of the lake, she climbed the porch steps and rang the bell. A moment later, a slim, attractive, 50-ish woman opened the door. She wore jeans, a sweater, and a knee-length apron decorated with needlepoint strawberries. "Mrs. Lambert?" Jane asked.
"Yes."
"We have a bond that I hope I can call upon." Gwyneth Lambert raised a half-smile and her eyebrows. Jane said, "We both married Marines."
"That's a bond, all right. How can I help you?"
"We're also both widows. And I believe we have the same people to blame for that." Chapter 6. The kitchen smelled of oranges. Gwyn Lambert was baking mandarin chocolate muffins in such quantity and with such industry that it was impossible not to suppose that she was busying herself as a defense against the sharper edges of her grief. On the counters were 9 plates, each holding half a dozen fully cooled muffins already covered in plastic wrap, destined for her neighbors and friends. A 10th plate of still warm treats stood on the dinette table, and another batch was rising to perfection in the oven. Gwyn was one of those impressive kitchen masters who produced culinary wonders with no apparent aftermath, no dirty mixing bowls or dishes in the sink, no flour dusting the counters, no crumbs or other debris on the floor. Having declined a muffin, Jane accepted a mug of strong black coffee. She and her hostess sat across the table from each other, fragrant steam rising languidly off the rich brew.
"Did you say your Nick was a lieutenant colonel?" Gwyn asked.
Jane had used her real name. The bond between her and Gwyn required this visit be kept secret. Under these circumstances, if she couldn't trust a Marine wife, she couldn't trust anyone. "Full colonel," Jane corrected. "He wore the silver eagle."
"At only 32. A boy with that kind of pep in his step would have gotten stars in time."
Gwyn's husband, Gordon, had been a lieutenant general, 3 stars, 1 rank below the highest officers in the Corps. Jane said, "Nick was awarded the Navy Cross and a DDS, plus an entire chest full of other stuff." The Navy Cross was 1 step below the Medal of Honor. Innately modest, Nick had never spoken of his medals and commendations, but sometimes Jane felt the need to brag about him, to confirm that he had existed and that his existence had made the world a better place. "I lost him 4 months ago. We were married 6 years."
"Honey," said Gwyn,
You must have been a true child bride.
Far from it. 21.
The wedding was the week after I graduated Quantico and made the bureau.
Gwyn looked surprised.
You're FBI?
If I ever go back. I'm on a leave of absence now.
We met when Nick was on assignment to the Corps Combat Development Command at Quantico. He didn't come on to me. I had to come on to him.
He was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen.
And I'm mule stubborn about getting what I want.
She surprised herself when her heart clutched and her voice broke.
These 4 months sometimes feel like 4 years. Then, like just 4 hours.
Her thoughtlessness at once dismayed her.
Damn, I'm sorry.
Your loss is fresher than mine.
Waving off the apology, unshed tears in her eyes, Gwyn said,
A year after we were married, 83 it was,
Gordy was in Beirut when terrorists blew up the Marine barracks, killed 220. He was so often somewhere bad. I imagined him dead 1,000 times. I thought all that imagining would prepare me to handle it if one day someone in dress blues knocked on the door with a KIA notice. But I wasn't prepared for the way it happened.
According to news stories, on a Saturday, little more than 2 weeks earlier, when his wife had been at the supermarket, Gordon let himself out the back gate in the picket fence and walked down the hill to the lakeshore. He carried a short-barrel, pistol-grip, pump-action shotgun. He sat near the water, his back against a grassy bank. Because of the short barrel, he was able to reach the trigger. Boaters on the lake sat witness as he shot himself in the mouth. When Gwyn came home from shopping, she found the street filled with sheriff's cruisers, her front door standing open, and her life forever changed.
Jane said, Do you mind my asking?
I'm hurting bad, but I'm not broken.
Ask. Any chance he went to the lake in the company of someone?
No, none.
The woman next door saw him going down there alone, carrying something, but she didn't realize it was a gun.
The boaters who witnessed it, have they all been cleared?
Gwyn looked puzzled.
Cleared of what?
Maybe your husband was to meet someone. Maybe he took the shotgun for protection.
And maybe it was murder?
Couldn't have been. There were 4 boats in the area. At least 6 people witnessed it.
Jane didn't want to ask the next question because it could seem to be an accusation that the Lamberts' marriage had been in trouble.
Was your husband... Was Gordon at all depressed?
Not ever.
Some people throw hope away. Gordy was chained to it all his life, an optimist's optimist.
Sounds like Nick, Jane said.
Every problem that came his way was just a challenge, and he loved challenges.
How did it happen, honey? How did you lose him?
I was making dinner. He went to the John. When he didn't come back, I found him fully clothed, sitting in the bathtub. He'd used his combat knife, the K-bar, to cut his neck so deeply that he severed his left carotid artery. Chapter 7. This had been a wet El Niño winter, the second in the past half decade, with normal rain in the intervening years, a climate anomaly that had ended the state's drought. Now the morning light at the windows dimmed as though dusk must be descending. Once glass smooth, the lake below lay stippled with white, a breeze scaling it as if it were a great serpent slumbering in the shadow of the pending storm. While Gwyn took the finished muffins out of the oven and put the pan on the drain board to cool, the ticking of the wall clock seemed to grow louder. During the past month, Timepieces of all kinds had periodically tormented Jane. Now and then she thought she could hear her wristwatch ticking faintly. It became so aggravating that she took it off and put it away in the car's glove box, or, if she was in a motel, carried it across the room to bury it under the cushion of an armchair until she needed it. If time was running out for her, she didn't want to be insistently reminded of that fact. As Gwyn poured fresh coffee for the two of them, Jane wondered, did Gordon leave a note?
Not a note. Not a text message. Not a voicemail. I don't know whether I wish he had or should be glad he didn't.
She returned the pot to the coffee maker and settled in her chair once more. Jane tried to ignore the clock, the louder ticking, no doubt imaginary. I keep a notepad and pen in my bedroom vanity drawer. Nick used them to write a final goodbye, if you can bend your mind to think of it that way. The eeriness of those four sentences frosted the chambers of her heart every time she considered them. She quoted, "Something is wrong with me. I very much need to be dead." Gwyn had picked up her coffee cup. She put it down without drinking from it.
"That's damn strange, isn't it?"
"I thought so. The police and medical examiner seemed to think so, too. The first sentence was in his tight, meticulous cursive, but the quality of the others steadily deteriorated, as if he had to struggle to control his hand." They stared out at the darkening day, sharing a silence. And then Gwyn said, "How awful for you to be the one to find him." That observation didn't need a reply. Staring into her coffee cup as though her future might be read in the patterns of reflected light made by the ceiling fixture, Jane said, "The U.S. suicide rate dropped to about 10.5 per 100,000 people late in the last century. But the last two decades, it's returned to the historic norm of 12.5. Until last April, when it began to climb. By the end of the year, the annual tally was 14 per 100,000. At the normal rate, that's over 38,000 cases. The higher rate is more than another 4,500 suicides. And from what I'm able to tell, the first 3 months of this year, it's running at 15.5, which by December 31st, will be almost 8,400 cases above the historic norm." As she recited the numbers for Gwyn, she puzzled over them yet again, but she still had no idea what to make of them or why they seemed germane to Nick's death. When she looked up, she saw Gwyn regarding her with rather more intensity than before.
"Honey, are you telling me you're doing research? Damn right you are. So there's more to this than you've said, isn't there?"
There was a great deal more, but Jane wouldn't share too much and possibly put the widow Lambert in jeopardy. Gwyn pressed her.
"Don't tell me we're back in some Cold War with all its dirty tricks. Are there a lot of military men in those extra 8,400 suicides?"
"Quite a few. But not a disproportionate share. It's equally distributed across professions. Doctors, lawyers, teachers, police, journalists. But they're unusual suicides. Successful and well-adjusted people with no history of depression or emotional problems or financial crisis. They don't fit any of the standard profiles of those with suicidal tendencies." A gust of wind pummeled the house, rattling the back door as if someone insistently tried the knob to see if the lock was engaged. Hope pinked the woman's face and brought a liveliness to her eyes that Jane had not seen before.
"Are you saying maybe Gordy was,
what,
drugged or something? He didn't know what he was doing when he took the shotgun down there?"
Is there a possibility?
I don't know, Gwen. I've found the littlest bits of things to piece together, and I can't see what they mean yet, if they mean anything at all. She tried the coffee, but had drunk enough of it. Was there any time in the past year when Gordon wasn't feeling well? Maybe a cold once, an abscessed tooth and a root canal. Spells of vertigo, mental confusion, headaches? Gordy wasn't a man for headaches, or for anything that slowed him down. This would have been memorable, a real hardcore migraine with the characteristic twinkling lights that mess with your vision. She saw this resonated with the Widow Lambert. When was it, Gwen? At the WIC, the What If conference, last September in Vegas. What's the what if? The Gernsback Institute brings together a panel of futurists and science fiction writers for 4 days. It challenges them to think outside the box about national defense. What threats are we not concentrating on that might turn out to be bigger than we think a year from now, 10 years, 20 years? She put one hand to her mouth, and her brow furrowed. Something wrong? Jane asked. Gwyn shrugged. No. Just for a second, I wondered if I should be talking about it. But it's not a big secret or anything. It's gotten a lot of press attention over the years. See, the Institute invites 400 of the most forward-thinking people, military officers from every branch of service, key scientists, and engineers from major defense contractors, to listen to the panels and ask questions. It's quite a thing. Spouses are welcome. We women attend the dinners and social events, but not the sessions. And it's not any kind of bribe, by the way. I didn't think it was. The Institute is an apolitical nonprofit. It doesn't have any ties to defense contractors, and when you receive an invitation, you have to pay your own travel and lodging. Gordy took me with him to 3 conferences. He just loved them. But last year, he had a bad migraine at the event. His only one ever. The 3rd day, in the morning, for almost 6 hours, he was flat in bed. I kept after him to call the front desk and find a doctor, but Gordy figured anything less than a bullet wound was best dealt with by letting it work itself out. You know how men are, always having to prove things to themselves. Jane warmed to a memory. Nick was woodworking, gouged his hand when a chisel slipped. It probably needed 4 or 5 stitches, but he cleaned the wound himself, packed it full of Neosporin, and bound it tight with duct tape. I thought he'd die of blood poisoning or lose his hand, and he thought my concern was so cute. Cute! I wanted so bad to smack him. In fact, I did smack him. Gwyn smiled. Good for you. Anyway, the migraine went away by lunchtime, and Gordy missed only 1 session. When I wasn't able to persuade him to see a doctor, I went to the spa and spent a bundle for a massage. But how did you know about the migraine? One of the other people I've interviewed, this widower in Chicago, his wife had her first and last migraine 2 months before she hung herself in their garage. Was she at the What If conference? No, I only wish it was that simple. I can't find links like that between a significant number of them, just fragile threads, tenuous connections. That woman was the CEO of a nonprofit serving people with disabilities. By all accounts, she was happy, productive, and beloved by virtually everyone. Did your Nick have a one and only migraine? Not that he mentioned. The suspicious suicides that interest me. In the months before they died, some complained of a few brief spells of vertigo or strange, intense dreams, or essential tremors of the mouth and the left hand that resolved after just a week or two. Some experienced a bitter taste that came and went. Different things, and mostly minor,
But Nick didn't have any unusual symptoms. Zero. Zip. Nada.
You've interviewed these people's loved ones?
Yes.
How many?
22 so far, including you. Reading Gwyn's expression, Jane said, "Yeah, I know. It's an obsession. Maybe it's a fool's errand."
You're nobody's fool, honey.
Sometimes it's just hard to move on.
Where will you go from here?
There's someone near San Diego I'd like to talk to. She leaned back in her chair. But this what-if event in Vegas still intrigues me.
Do you have anything from the conference? A brochure? Especially a program for those 4 days?
There's probably something in Gordon's study upstairs. I'll go look.
More coffee?
No, thanks. I had a lot with breakfast. What I do need is a bathroom.
There's a half bath off the hall. Come along, I'll show you.
A couple of minutes later, in the spiderless, spotless powder bath, as Jane washed her hands at the sink, she met her reflection, eye to eye. Not for the first time, she wondered if by setting out on this crusade 2 months earlier, she'd done the very worst of wrong things. She had so much to lose, and not just her life, least of all, her life. From the roof, by way of the bathroom vent duct, the growing wind spoke down through the second floor to the first, like some troll that had moved from under his traditional bridge to a home with a view. As she stepped out of the bathroom, a gunshot barked upstairs. Chapter 8. Jane drew her pistol, held it in both hands, muzzle pointed to her right, at the floor. It was not her FBI gun. She wasn't allowed that weapon while on leave. She liked this one as much, maybe even better. A Heckler & Koch Combat Competition Mark 23, chambered for 45 ACP. The noise had been a gunshot. Unmistakable. No scream before it, no scream after it. No footsteps. She knew she hadn't been followed from Arizona. If somebody had already been waiting here for her, he would have taken her when she was sitting at the kitchen table, widow to widow, her defenses down. Maybe the guy was holding Gwyn captive and fired one round to draw Jane to the second floor. That didn't make sense. But then most bad guys were emotion-driven, short on logic and reason. She thought of another possibility, but she didn't want to go there yet. If the house had back stairs, they would likely be in the kitchen. She hadn't noticed them. There had been two closed doors. A pantry, of course. The other was most likely the door to the garage or to a laundry room. Okay. The front stairs were the only stairs. She didn't like the stairs. Nowhere to dodge left or right, no possibility of retreat, because she'd be turning her back on the shooter. Once she committed, she could only go up, each of the two narrow flights like a close-range shooting gallery. At the landing between flights, she stayed low, slipped fast around the newel post. Nobody at the top. Heart knocking like a parade drum. Bite on the fear. She knew what to do. She'd done it before. One of her instructors had said it was a ballet without tights and tutus. You just needed to know the moves, exactly where to make them, and at the end of the performance, they would throw flowers at your feet, metaphorically speaking. The last flight. This was where a professional should try to take her. Aiming down, his gun would be just below eye level. Aiming up, hers would be in her line of sight, giving him the sure shot. Top of the stairs, and still alive. Stay crouched and close to the wall, both hands on the pistol, arms extended. Stop and listen. No one in the upstairs hall. Now it was all about clearing doorways, which sucked nearly as much as the stairs. Crossing a threshold, she could be hosed right here at the end of it. Gwyn Lambert occupied an armchair in the master bedroom, head rolled to the left. Her right arm had fallen into her lap, the gun still loosely held. The bullet had entered her right temple, tunneled her brain, and broken out the left temple, spattering the carpet with chunks of bone and twists of hair, and worse. Chapter 9. The scene didn't appear to have been staged. It was a true suicide. No scream before the gunshot, no footsteps or other sound afterward. Only the motion and the act, and terror or relief or regret in the instant between them. A nightstand drawer hung open, where the home defense weapon might have been kept. Although Jane hadn't known Gwyneth long enough to be wrenched with grief, dull but awful sadness and sharp anger afflicted her, the latter because this was no ordinary suicide, no consequence of anguish or depression. For a woman only 2 weeks from the loss of her husband, Gwyn had been coping as well as anyone might, baking muffins, soon to take them to family and friends who had supported her in the current darkness, looking to the future. Besides, of the little she had learned about this military wife, one thing she knew beyond doubt was that Gwyn would not have tormented another grieving widow by putting her in the position of having to be the first to discover yet another suicide. A sudden beeping caused her to pivot from the dead woman and bring her pistol up. No one. The sound issued from an adjacent room. She approached the open doorway with caution until she recognized the tone was the AT&T signal alerting its customer that a phone had been left off the hook. She crossed the threshold into Gordon Lambert's study. On the walls were photographs of him as a younger man, in combat gear, with brother Marines in exotic places. Gordon in dress blues, tall and handsome, pictured posing with a president. A framed flag that had flown in battle. Trailing on its coiled cord, the handset of the desk phone lay on the carpet. From a jacket pocket, she fished a cotton handkerchief that she carried for no purpose other than fingerprint avoidance, and she cradled the handset, wondering with whom Gwyn might have spoken before making her mortal decision. She lifted the phone and entered the automatic callback code, but got nothing. Gwyn had ostensibly come upstairs to find a brochure or program for the What If conference. Jane went to the desk, opened a drawer. The phone rang. She was not surprised. There was no caller ID. She picked up the receiver, but said nothing. Her discretion was matched by the person on the farther end of the line. It was neither a phantom call initiated by a system glitch, nor a wrong number. She heard music in the background, an old song by America recorded before she'd been born, A Horse with No Name. She hung up first. Considering the large properties in this neighborhood, it was unlikely the single shot had been heard, but she had urgent work to do. Chapter 10. Maybe someone was coming. Or maybe they had no agent in this vicinity, but prudence required that she expect hostile visitors. She had no time to search the general's office. On the ground floor, she wiped everything that she remembered touching. She quickly washed and put away the coffee mugs and spoons. Although no one could hear, she performed each task quietly. Week by week, she had grown quieter in all things, as though she was preparing soon to be a ghost and silent forever. In the half-bath, the mirror captured her attention briefly. Such was the fantastic nature of the mission she had set out upon, so strange were the discoveries she was making. Sometimes it seemed reasonable to think that the impossible might be possible. In this instance, that when she left the room, her image would remain in the mirror to incriminate her. When she departed the house by the front door, she felt not unlike the angel of death. She came. A woman died. She left. Some said that one day there would be no death. If they were right, death, too, could die. As she walked past the neighbors' houses, she saw no one at a window, no one on a porch, no child at play in risk of the pending storm. The only sounds were those that the inconstant wind stirred from the materials of the day, as though humanity had been expunged, its constructions intact, but now to be erased by eons of weather. She drove to the end of the block, where she could either turn left or continue straight. She motored ahead half a mile, made a right turn, and soon a left, with no immediate destination in mind, glancing repeatedly at her rearview mirror. Confident that she had no tail hanging at a distance, she found the interstate and drove west toward San Diego. The day might come when the Earth fell under such precise and continuous observation that vehicles without transponders were no less trackable than those lawfully equipped. In such a world, she would never have made it to the Lambert House in the first place. Chapter 11. One night the previous November, 6 days before Nick's death, while she'd been waiting in bed for him as he brushed his teeth, she had seen a story on the TV news that intrigued her, and that lately had circled back again and again in her memory, as though it must be pertinent to what she was currently enduring. The piece had been about scientists who were developing brain implants using light-sensitive proteins and fiber optics. They said we had a ceaseless conversation with our brains, our senses writing in information, our brains interpreting it and reading out instructions. Experiments were being done in which cerebral implants could take the brain's instructions and transmit them past points of communication breakdown, such as stroke and spinal nerve damage, making it possible for a paraplegic to operate prosthetic limbs just by thinking about moving them. People with certain motor neuron diseases that locked them in their bodies, even denying them the ability to speak, might be able, with such implants, to think their side of a conversation and hear it spoken. Their thoughts, translated into luminous pulses by light-sensitive proteins, would be processed by software and rendered into speech by a computer. At the time, Jane had marveled that everything was changing so rapidly, that ahead seemed to be fast coming a world of miracles and wonders. Now, she was trapped in a world of violence and horror to which that old news story seemed to have no relevance, and yet she kept recalling it, as if it mattered profoundly. Maybe she remembered the story not because of anything in it, but because of what Nick had said to her shortly thereafter. He came to bed exhausted from a hard day, as she also was exhausted. Neither had the energy to make love, but they enjoyed lying side by side, holding hands and talking. Just before she fell asleep, he raised her hand to his lips, kissed it, and said, "You rock me." His words followed her into the most lovely dreams, where they were spoken in a variety of whimsical situations, always with great tenderness. Chapter 12.
In Benny's at the Beach, the attack on Philadelphia commuters was as commanding of the clientele as would have been the Stanley Cup. 24/7, there was enough TV sports coverage, live and replay, to satiate any fan. But on this lunch hour, the two bar screens were tuned to cable news, the bottom crawl devoted to death counts and statements of outrage from politicians, rather than to past victories and player stats. Benny's was not, in fact, at the beach, but two blocks from the sound of lapping surf, and if it had been a San Diego favorite for 50 years, as its sign claimed, it most likely was no longer owned by someone named Benny, if it had ever been. The customers appeared to be middle class, a shrinking demographic during the past decade. At this hour, none had drunk enough to bluster in the face of horror, though Jane found almost tangible the anger, fear, and need for community that had brought them to their barstools and chairs. She ate in the last booth, which was narrower than the others, made for two instead of four. The laminated granite tabletop had surely been Formica when Benny ruled the room. The tables and the designer fabric on the booth bench cushions and the bar stools, along with a marble tile floor in a harlequin pattern, laid a claim to prosperity and status never quite fulfilled, but so American that Jane found it surprisingly poignant. Among the customers, a columnist for the local newspaper was having lunch and a beer or two, though he could not restrain his reportorial instincts. She watched him moving through the long room with notebook, pen, and bottle of Heineken, passing out his card and engaging patrons in discussions of the latest act of terrorism. He was about 40, with good hair that looked as if he spent more on styling than an accountant would have advised. He was proud of his tush, wearing his jeans the slightest bit too tight. He liked his manly forearms as well, and wore his shirt sleeves rolled up on a day not warm enough for that. He came to her booth as both a reporter and a man, with the calculation in his eye that some women found offensive, but that she did not. He wasn't boorish, and he had no way of knowing she'd taken herself out of the game. She was well aware that men noticed her in any circumstance, and she knew that if she refused a 3-minute interview, whether politely or dismissively, she would linger longer and more vividly in his memory. His name was Kelsey, and she said her name was Mary, and at her invitation he sat across the table from her.
Terrible day.
One of them.
Do you have friends or family in Philadelphia?
Just fellow citizens.
Yeah. It still hurts, doesn't it?
It should.
What do you think we ought to do about it?
You and I?
All of us.
Realize it's part of a bigger problem.
Which is?
Ideas shouldn't matter more than people. He raised an eyebrow.
That's interesting. Explain a little.
By way of explanation, she reversed the order of two words and eliminated a contraction. People should matter more than ideas. He waited for her to continue. When instead she took the next-to-last bite of her burger, he said,
My column's not political. It's human interest stuff. But if you had to put a political label on yourself, what would it say?
Disgusted. He laughed, making notes.
Might be the biggest political party of all. Where are you from?
Miami, she lied. You know a story you should look into?
What's that?
The increasing rate of suicide.
Is it increasing?
Check it out. He watched her, even as he tipped back his bottle of beer and drank.
Why would a girl like you have such a morbid interest?
I'm a sociologist, she lied. You ever suspect that shit like this Philadelphia attack gets used? Although he wrote a column of human interest stories, he had police reporter eyes,
that didn't just look at things, that flinched them layer by layer.
Gets used how?
She gestured toward the nearer TV. That story they give like a minute to every hour between bouts of Philly coverage. A former governor of Georgia had shot and killed his wife, a wealthy contributor to his campaigns, and himself.
You mean the Atlanta atrocity?
Kelsey said, which was the tabloid title already slapped on that case.
Hideous thing.
If it happened yesterday, it would be the big story, but it happens same day as Philly, and no one remembers it by next week. He didn't seem to get her implication.
They say the wife and the deep pockets donor were having an affair.
Having finished her burger, she wiped her hands on a napkin. There you have one of the greatest mysteries of our time.
Which is?
Who the hell they are that we're always hearing about. He smiled, indicated her empty bottle.
Buy you a Dos Equis?
Thanks, but one's my limit. You know, the murder rate has also been going up.
We've done stories on that, sure.
The waitress appeared, and Jane asked for the check. Leaning across the table toward Kelsey, she whispered, It's a good bet what numbers will be up next. Leaning toward her, taking her intimacy for some kind of invitation, he said,
Tell me.
Murder suicides. The governor might be an indication of things to come. The next phase, so to speak.
The next phase of what?
Having been sincere to this point, she played it deadpan when she slipped into fantasy that would send him on his way.
Of what started at Roswell?
He was too practiced a journalist to let his smile freeze or his eyes glaze over.
Roswell, New Mexico?
That's where they first landed. You're not a UFO denier.
Not at all, he said. The universe is infinite. No thinking person would believe we're alone in it.
But by the time the waitress brought the check, Kelsey had declined to take the bait when she asked if he believed in alien abductions, had thanked Jane, or Mary from Miami, for sharing, and moved on to another interview. After paying cash and wending through the lunchtime crowd, she glanced back, perhaps intuitively, and saw the columnist staring at her. As he looked away, he brought a cell phone to his ear. He was just a guy who had come on to her, a guy whom she had turned away rather cleverly, just a guy who still liked what he saw. The phone was a coincidence. It had nothing to do with her. Nevertheless, once outside, she moved fast. Chapter 13. White kites against the looming storm's volcanic dark plumes. Gulls swooped in from the sea and scalloped down the sky to safe roosts in the eaves of buildings and among the fronds of phoenix palms. Jane could have parked in the restaurant lot. She had not. She had left the Ford at a meter around the corner and two blocks away. She approached the vehicle from the farther side of the street, seeming to have no interest in it, all the while surveying the scene to determine if the Ford might be staked out. Not for the first time. She told herself that this was how fully formed paranoids jittered their way through life, but she still believed in her sanity. Although she saw no surveillance, she walked a block past the escape before crossing the street and approaching it from behind. The reporter had thanked her for sharing, and in fact, she had always been a sharing person, in the sense that she had been open with others regarding her feelings, hopes, intentions, and beliefs. Her current isolation, therefore, proved that much harder to bear. Because friendship required sharing. She had to forego seeing old friends and making new ones for the duration. Sharing might be the death of her, or of those with whom she shared. When she'd sold her house, when she'd converted everything she owned into cash and stashed it where it could not easily be found, she had thought the duration might be 6 months. Now, 2 months into this journey and almost 3,000 miles from where it had begun, she no longer had the false confidence to put a tentative end date to the mission. She pulled away from the curb, inserting the Ford into a river of vehicles. In nearly every case, each car and SUV and truck and bus was continuously signaling its position for the benefit of commercial collectors of mega data, police agencies, and whoever owned the future. Chapter 14. The new San Diego Central Library, either a postmodern triumph or a regrettable hodgepodge, depending on your taste, had nearly 500,000 square feet spread over 9 floors, making it too big for Jane's purposes. Its spaces were too thoroughly surveilled for her comfort, and too difficult to exit with alacrity and stealth in an emergency. She went in search of an older branch library. She had disposed of her laptop weeks earlier. These days, they served as locators no less than did a vehicle's GPS. Her preferred computer source was a public library, wherever she might be. Even then, depending on the information she sought and reviewed online, she didn't linger long at any location. She found a branch in the Spanish Mission style, derivative but honest architecture with a barrel tile roof, palest yellow stucco walls, windows with bronze frames and muntins. Thriving banana palms sculled the air with their large paddle-like fronds, as if to row the building backward in time to a more serene era. The parking area serving the library also abutted a park with winding paths, a picnic area, and a playground. As had become her habit, Jane drove past her destination and curbed the car on a side street a block and a half away. After removing a small notebook, a pen, and a wallet, she tucked her purse under the seat before she got out and locked the doors. Inside the branch library, there were many more aisles of books than there were of computers. She chose a workstation 2 removed from one occupied by a surly-looking street person, whose presence assured that other patrons would avoid that entire quadrant of computers. Wild witch's broom of dark hair, street-corner prophet beard bristling and woven through with a white streak as though stiffened and selectively bleached by a lightning bolt, wearing lace-up boots and camouflage pants and green flannel shirt and voluminous black-quilted nylon jacket, the hulking man had apparently defeated the library's block on obscene websites and was watching pornography with the sound off. He didn't do so much as glance at Jane, and he didn't fondle himself. He sat with his hands on the tabletop, and he considered the action on the screen with something like boredom and with what seemed to be puzzlement. There were drugs, such as ecstasy, that if taken in too great a quantity for too long, caused the brain to stop producing natural endorphins, so that you could no longer experience rapture, joy, or a sense of well-being without chemical assistance. Perhaps that might be his condition, because his sun-seared and weathered face remained without expression as he stared with the stillness and apparent incomprehension of a sculpture of a man. Online, Jane searched for and found the Gernsback Institute, which produced the annual What If Conference, among other events. Its stated purpose was to inspire the imagination of leaders in business, science, government, and the arts for the purpose of encouraging informed speculation in search of outside-the-box solutions to significant problems facing humanity. Do-gooders. For people with malicious intentions, no better cover existed than a non-profit organization dedicated to bettering the human condition. Most of the people at the Institute might, in fact, mean well and be doing good. But that didn't mean they grasped the hidden intentions of its founders or their core mission. In the notebook, she recorded data that seemed most pertinent to her investigation. She used numerical and alphabetical codes of her own devising so that this information was in a form that no one but she would be able to read. Now, she entered the coded names of the officers and 9 board members of the Institute, only one of which, David James Michael, rang in her memory. David James Michael, the man with 3 first names. He was somewhere else in this compilation of names, dates, and places. She would pore through it later to find him. Having bumped out of the porn site, the homeless man now watched dog videos on YouTube, again with the speakers muted, his hands resting on each side of the keyboard, his time-beaten face as expressionless as a clock. After she logged off and pocketed her notebook and pen, Jane got to her feet, moved nearer to the guy, and put a pair of $20 bills on the table beside his computer. "Thank you for your service to the country." He looked up at her as if she had spoken in a language unknown to him. His eyes were not bloodshot, neither were they bleary from booze, but gray and clear and keenly observant. When he said nothing, she indicated the tattoo on the back of his right hand, a blue spearhead as background, within which was a complete raised sword in gold, bisected by 3 golden lightning bolts, the insignia of Army Special Forces Airborne, and under that, the letters DDT. "Can't have been light duty." Nodding toward the $40, he said,
"There's them who need it more than me."
He had the voice of a bear with strep throat. "But I don't know them," she said. "I'd be grateful if you gave it to them for me."
"I can do that."
He did not pick up the money, but turned his attention once more to the dog videos.
"There's a free kitchen near here that can always use donations."
Jane didn't know if she had done the right thing, but it was the only thing she could have done. As she left the alcove where the computers were arrayed, she glanced back, but he was not looking at her. Chapter 15. Still, the storm had not broken. The sky over San Diego loomed heavy with midday dark, as if all the water weight and potential thunder stored over distant Alpine had, in the last few hours, slid, unspent, toward the city, to add pressure to the coastal deluge that was coming. Sometimes both weather and history broke far too slowly for those who were impatient for what came next. In the park adjacent to the library, following a winding path, she saw ahead a fountain surrounded by a reflecting pool, and she walked to it and sat on one of the benches, facing the water that flowered up in numerous thin streams, petaling the air with silver droplets. The park was sparsely populated for the hour, only 6 people in sight, 2 of them walking dogs less leisurely than they might have under a more benevolent sky. Jane took her case notebook from an inner sport coat pocket, paged to the growing list of names, and found a previous entry for David James Michael. He was the man who, as she'd discovered in her recent library session, sat on the board of the Gernsback Institute that organized the invitation-only What If conference attended by Gordon and Gwyn Lambert, now both dead by their own hands. The notation after the first listing for Michael referred her to the suicide of a T. Quinn Eubanks in Traverse City, Michigan. Eubanks, a man of inherited wealth and considerable personal achievement, had sat on the board of directors of three charitable foundations, including the Seedling Fund, where one of his fellow directors was David James Michael. Her next line of inquiry was now clear, or as clear as anything got in this case. First, however, she had to make a call to Chicago. At all times, she carried a disposable phone with prepaid minutes. As far as she knew, disposables had never been trackable. Even if such bargain models now emitted identifying signals, she always bought them with cash and needed no ID to activate service. A bevy of uniformed schoolgirls hurried past in response to the mother quail urgings of a nun in a contemporary habit who seemed to think the storm would break at any moment. The air was yet too still. Like tectonic plates, a mass of cool air and a warmer mass would strike slip and throw down a sudden rush of wind, and the downpour would come a minute or two after that. Confident of her atmospheric intuition, and not wanting to use the phone while in the car, where she could be trapped in the event that she was wrong about the security of a disposable cell, Jane extracted her current phone from an interior jacket pocket and entered the number for Sydney Root's direct line. Sydney's wife, Eileen, had been the Chicago-based advocate for the rights of people with disabilities, about whom Jane had told Gwyneth Lambert. Eileen Root suffered a first and last migraine headache while away from home at a seminar, and 3 weeks later hung herself in the garage of the family home. Like Jane's husband, Sydney's wife left a note before killing herself, an even more disturbing, cryptic message than Nick's. "Sweet Say-So says he's lonely all these years. Why did Leany stop needing him? He was always there for Leany. Now I need to be there for him." Neither Sydney nor his and Eileen's, Leany's, three children, who were all in their 20s, had ever heard of a man named Say-So. Jane had traveled to Chicago and met with Sydney Root soon after being granted leave from the Bureau, early in her unofficial investigation, before she discovered that because of such inquiries, she would be targeted by a mysterious conspiracy as elusive as a confederacy of ghosts. She had used her real name then, and, of necessity, she used it now, when he answered on the third ring.
"Oh, yes, I tried to call you a few days ago," he said, "but the number you gave me was out of service."
"I moved, went through a lot of changes," she said, which was as much explanation as she would give him. "But I've still got this monkey on my back, you know, still looking for an explanation, and I hoped you might spare me a few minutes."
"Sure. Just let me close my office door."
He was an architect in a large practice with four partners. He put her on hold, and a few seconds later returned.
"Okay, what can I do for you?"
"I know the world of nonprofits is enormous, and it was your wife who moved in those circles, not you so much. But do you recall Eileen talking about something called the Gernsback Institute?" He thought a moment, but then said,
"Means nothing."
"What about the Seedling Fund?"
"That neither."
"Now a couple of names. David James Michael?"
Sorry, no."
"Quinn Eubanks?"
"I'm not always good with names."
"The seminar in Boston where Eileen had the migraine. You said that event was a presentation of Harvard University."
"Yes. You can look it up."
"I did. But I'm wondering if she attended any other conference shortly before or after that one."
"Eileen was passionate about her work. She had a busy schedule. I can't recall, but I could find out for you."
"I'd be grateful, Sydney. Say, by this time tomorrow?
You really do still have that monkey on your back.
Don't forget those suicide statistics I gave you.
I remember. But as I told you at the time, look around at all the craziness in the world, all the violence and hatred these days, the economic crises, and you don't need any other explanation for why more people would be more depressed than ever.
Except that Eileen wasn't depressed.
Well, no, but...
And neither was Nick.
She wasn't depressed, Sydney said. But that's what I tried to call you about the other day. You remember the note she left?
Jane quoted the opening of it from memory. Sweet Say-So says he's lonely all these years.
We didn't share the contents widely at first, Sydney said, because it was so strange. Not like Eileen. We didn't want people to remember her as mentally ill, I guess. Recently, her only living aunt, Faye, found out about the note and solved the mystery. Sort of. For a while, when Eileen was 4 and 5, she had an imaginary friend named Say-So. She talked to him, made up stories about him. Like that kind of thing always does, it passed. Who knows why at the end she would flash back to that.
Jane shivered at the idea of a long-forgotten imaginary friend calling a 50-year-old woman to join him in death, though if she'd been asked to explain the chill, she couldn't have done so.
How are you doing? Sydney asked.
Good enough. I don't sleep well.
Me neither. Sometimes if I snore myself awake, I apologize to her for the noise. I mean, out loud. I forget she's not there.
I've been traveling a lot, staying in motels, she said. And I can't sleep in a double bed. Nick was a big guy, so it has to be queen or king size. Otherwise, it's like admitting he's gone, and I don't sleep at all.
Are you still on leave from the bureau?
Yeah.
Take my advice. Go back to work. Real work. Instead of chasing an explanation for something that can't ever be fully explained.
Maybe I will, she lied.
I don't mean to nudge, but work has helped me.
Maybe I will, she lied again.
Give me your new phone number so I can call you when I find out if Eileen was at another conference around that time.
I'll call you tomorrow, she said. Thanks, Sydney. You're a peach. When she hung up, she appeared to be the only person remaining in the park. The lawns and pathways were deserted to the limits of vision. Not one pigeon strutting, not one scurrying squirrel. At the wrong time, in the wrong place, a city could be as isolate as the Arctic. On the flanking streets to the north and south, traffic passed. Grumble of engines, swish of tires, hiss of air brakes, occasional bleat of horn, rattle of a loosely fit manhole cover. Even as she stepped away from the sizzle of the spritzing fountain, the traffic noise seemed curiously muffled, as if the park were enclosed with insulated dual-pane glass. The air remained calm under pressure, the sky full of iron-dark mountains that would soon collapse in a deluge, the city expectant, the windows of buildings shimmering with light that normally would be faded by the sun at this hour, drivers switching on headlights, the vehicles gliding through the faux dusk like submersibles following undersea lanes. Jane had taken only a few steps from the fountain when she detected a buzz like swarming wasps. At first, it seemed to come from above her, and then from behind. But when she turned in a circle and faced again the grove of palms toward which she had been moving, she saw the source, hovering 20 feet away. A drone. Chapter 16. The high-end civilian model quadcopter drone, a small fraction of the size of any military version, resembled a miniature unmanned moonlander combined with an insect. It appeared similar to the DJI Inspire 1 Pro, though somewhat larger. About $7,000 worth of aeronautics. These were used by real estate companies to film for sale properties and were increasingly put to work by many other commercial enterprises. They were also favored by well-heeled hobbyists who ranged from legitimate drone enthusiasts to the contemporary equivalent of peeping toms. Hovering only 8 or 10 feet off the ground, in the shadows under the cascading crowns of the phoenix palms, it was an effigy of the feared machine god of 1,000 movies and stories, a lighter-than-air menace with heavy-as-a-sledgehammer impact that sent a jolt of fear through her. The craft was in violation of all the rules applying to civilian drone use, at least as Jane knew them. She didn't imagine that its presence here could be a mere coincidence. Its three-axis gimbaled camera remained trained on her. Somehow, she'd given them her location. What her mistake might have been did not matter right now. She could work that out later. If a backup battery provided the craft with twice the flight time of an Inspire 1 Pro, it could remain in the air for 30 to 40 minutes, which meant it must have been launched from somewhere in the vicinity, most likely from a surveillance van. The drone operator would monitor her until enough officers arrived to arrest her. Or maybe they weren't from a legitimate law enforcement agency, in which case there would be no officers, and they would just take her. They were after her. The omnipotent, almost mystical they. But she had no idea who they might be. In any case, they were already near. The park still appeared deserted. Not for long. She didn't try to run at once, but instead moved toward the drone when she saw something about it that required taking a better look. Her boldness allowed her to detect, sooner than she would have otherwise, that this either was not a civilian model or had been radically customized in the aftermarket. Maybe the stormlight and the shadows misled her, although she knew they didn't. And maybe in her paranoia she conjured out of innocent shapes the presence of a sound suppressor wrapping the narrow bore of a muzzle. But she knew that paranoia had nothing to do with it. The drone had been weaponized. As the machine drifted toward her, she dodged to one side, behind the thick bole of a phoenix palm. Had she turned and run at once, she would have been shot in the back. In that brief and desperate moment of cover, she drew the Heckler & Koch from her shoulder rig. Her mind raced, trying to grasp the threat to its fullest nature. The problem of weight mitigated against a civilian-style drone being converted to a weapon with a high-capacity magazine. Without a gun, the average craft, with camera and battery, weighed about 8 pounds. The weight of artillery and ammo would affect stability and greatly reduce flight time. So it would have to be a low-caliber weapon loaded with but a few rounds, and she doubted it would be accurate. Of course, it only needed to be on target once. She expected the remote control assassin to sweep into view from her left. Then she heard it circumnavigating the massive old palm from the right. Before the camera could find her, she eased away from it. With her back to the 3-foot diameter trunk of the immense phoenix, she followed in the wake of the drone as it circled toward her. The firing mechanism wouldn't be a full handgun. No grip, no standard magazine, just the bare essentials. A .22 caliber weapon, something like a miniature belt feed with, say, 4 rounds. She had the advantage of hearing. The drone had an eye, but not an ear. The remote operator was essentially deaf. But copper-jacketed hollow-point rounds, even just 22s, could kill at close range. She stopped trying to hide, stepped away from the tree, quickly around it, boldly closing behind the drone. The operator had maybe a 70-degree field of view. He must have sensed a threat in his blind zone. With an angry hornet noise, the drone suddenly began to rotate in hover mode. With her pistol in a two-hand grip, at point-blank range, Jane squeezed off 3, 4, 5 rounds, the roar of each shot banking like a cue ball off every palm bowl in the grove. The freaking machine was all landing legs and propellers with a narrow fuselage, the camera suspended on a gimbal ring, not much of a target, so that she wished her pistol had been a shotgun. On the other hand, this grandmother of the Terminator wasn't armored or to any extent designed to withstand incoming fire. Whether she hit it with one round or 5, it spat off pieces of itself, reeled through the air, ricocheted off another palm, and clattered across the grass, thousands of dollars in value reduced to pennies in salvage. She didn't realize there was a second drone until she saw it coming fast from the area of the fountain. Chapter 17. 2 drones. A surveillance van from which they were launched, surely a quad or more of guys on foot, about to appear from somewhere soon. They had resources, and they wanted her. Maybe even with more intensity than she had imagined. When she pivoted to run from the second machine, the massive old phoenix palm blocked her. Before she could juke around the tree, a quiver of slender steel needles stippled it in a vertical line, missing her by a few inches. Should have known. An 8 or 10 pound airborne drone could not take the recoil of even a 22 and maintain accuracy. This was a low-recoil compressed air weapon, firing darts. Not darts, exactly. These were without fins, so they were technically miniature versions of the quarrels used by crossbows. Poison? Tranquilizer? Probably the latter. They would want to interrogate her. So from her point of view, poison might be preferable. Out of sight from the street, Jane wove among the palms, and the machine buzzed in pursuit as birds racketed out of the protection of the overhead cascading fronds, shrieking and nattering their dismay at being chased back into the pending storm. The big crowns of the palms ensured the bowls were farther apart than she needed them to be, forcing her to spend too much time in the open. Weaving, ducking, she counted on the drone not being able to click on her, but as she urgently sought cover, she realized there was no option except continued frantic evasion. The machine could fly at maybe 20 meters per second in calm air, much faster than she could run. She couldn't evade it for long, and she would never again get away with the circling the tree trick that worked before. The drone might be mindless, but its remote operator was not. The gunfire would draw police, but that wasn't necessarily a good thing. 2 months earlier, when all this started, she learned that not all cops were on the side of the righteous, that in this dangerous time when shadows cast shadows of their own, when darkness often passed for light, the just and the unjust wore the same face. Weaving tree to tree in an obstacle course marathon that she could only lose, in a dream-strange showdown among the phoenixes from which she would not rise phoenix-like if she were killed, Jane felt a tugging at her right sleeve. Dodging around another palm, she saw 3 thin quarrels pinned through the slack material of her sport coat, having missed her flesh by a fraction of an inch. In the early gloaming of the shrouded afternoon, a sudden brightness flashed apocalyptic, flaring across the park as if to incinerate all it touched and bespeak a world of ashes soon to come, so that all the shadows either leaped back into the things that cast them or quaked across the lawns and walks like spirits dispossessed and seeking new anchorage. She didn't realize the sky had thrown down lightning that had struck nearby until a second after the flare, when thunder shook the day so hard that she could feel it tremble the ground under her running feet. One of the many lessons she'd been taught at Quantico was to live by her training, to do what was known to work for 1,000 times 1,000 other lawmen, but also to recognize when by the book would result in a eulogy and a post-mortem commendation, and then to trust the intuition that was truer than anything learned. In the wake of the blinding light, the tide of banished shadows rushed back in answer to the thunder's call. As the day darkened around her, she dropped to the ground, rolled onto her back, as vulnerable as an offering on an Aztec altar, the airborne executioner looming as if to the call of sacrificial blood. She saw the hovering drone adjust the barrel of its gimbaled weapon, and she thrust the pistol toward it, squeezing off the remaining 5 rounds in the handgun. A glitter of steel flicked past her face, stitching the earth, as the machine fired a misaimed burst. Hit. The drone shuddered up and back, as if to gain altitude and retreat. Instead, having lost one of its rotary wings, it dipped and swayed, bobbled as it strove to execute a turn, accelerated in a cant toward a gap in the trees, and collided with a palm bole at maybe 10 meters per second, coming apart like a hurled egg. Jane was on her feet, without remembering how she'd gotten up. She ejected the empty magazine, pocketed it, snapped a full 10 rounds into the Heckler & Koch, holstered the weapon, and ran. Chapter 18. Out of the palm grove, in the open near the fountain, she saw them coming at last. 2 guys hurried this way from the library lot, which was west of her, and 3 others sprinted in from the street on the north side of the park, none in uniform, though they were surely not citizens out for the exercise. The Ford Escape stood at a meter a block to the south of the park, but she didn't want to lead them toward the car if it might be still unknown to them. She fled east, into the longest sward of this green zone, glad that she had been avoiding carbs, doing stretching exercises every evening, and running regularly. Even at a distance, she could tell that the 5 on her tail were formidable enough to have qualified for the NFL at defensive positions, huge guys, big muscles, serious stamina. But she weighed 115 pounds, and each of her pursuers bulked twice her size. Greater weight required additional energy to move it. She was lean and fleet, and her motivation, survival, gave her a more powerful motor than anything that might be driving them. She did not glance back. To do so would slow her. She would be caught or not. And the race was more often won by the quarry that had confidence in its endurance. The second lightning bolt seared the sky, brighter than the first, and cleaved to the heart the tallest tree in sight, a nearby live oak, from which foamed showers of fiery splinters, incandescent chips of bark. A slab calved from the main trunk, bearing a limb of intricate branches like some fantastic microwave mast receiving signals from unaccountable worlds. Although the toppling mass crashed short of her, Jane raised one arm across her face, protecting her eyes from the shrapnel of shattered branches, twigs, and crisp brown oval leaves set afire and swarming like a pestilence of beetles. As the last of the debris fell behind her and the crash of thunder rolled away through the city, as she came to the east end of the park, the once dark sky paled, abruptly glaucous, and cataracts of rain fell hard, fat droplets hissing through the trees and grass, snapping off the pavement, plinking the metal hoods on trash cans, carrying with them the faint bleachy odor of ozone, a form of oxygen created by lightning's alchemy. The torrents of silver rain were suddenly threaded through with red skeins as brake lights revealed drivers reacting to the abrupt drop in visibility. Without hesitation, she leaped off the sidewalk, into the street, blacktop glistering underfoot, and plunged into the mid-block traffic, greeted by the blare of horns and the banshee shriek of brakes. She briefly glimpsed some startled and some angry faces in the wake of thumping windshield wipers before they blurred behind the fresh rain sluicing down the glass. Arriving on the farther sidewalk intact, she turned south and ran flat out, dodging among other pedestrians who might have been annoyed but not surprised to see a young woman, sans umbrella, in a hurry to find shelter. She turned north at the corner, sprinted half a block before trading the street for an alleyway, then the alleyway for a narrow service passage between buildings, suitable only for foot traffic. Halfway along that claustrophobic access way, she at last risked a look back. She saw none of the five bulls from the park, but she knew she couldn't have shaken off all of them. They were in the area, and likely to cross her path by surprise. She paused, only to drop her disposable cell phone through the bars of a drainage grill. Even above the chorus of the rain, she could hear it splash into dark water below. And then she ran once more. Chapter 19. From the narrow accessway, she entered a new street mid-block. She was about to cross it when she noticed, 50 or 60 yards to her left, on the opposite side of the avenue, a large man in dark clothing, soaked as she was, standing oblivious to the bustling pedestrians around him. He might have been anybody, nobody, looking for somebody else. But intuition cautioned her to back off toward the passageway from which she had a moment earlier departed. Just before she would have ducked out of sight, she saw him see her. He raised his head and stiffened, as an attack dog will freeze for just an instant when it catches the scent of quarry. She retreated to the 3-foot-wide accessway and ran, blinking rain from her eyes, dispirited by the sound of her labored, open-mouthed breathing, throat hot and getting raw, heart knocking, a thin acid refluxing into the back of her throat. Insane, this woman hunt in broad daylight, in a busy city. Insane and incredible, but no more incredible than Nick killing himself with his K-bar, than Eileen Root hanging herself in the garage, than jihadists crashing a plane into hundreds of cars, trucks, and buses on a crowded expressway. Bursting into the alley she had traveled previously, acutely aware that she didn't have time to reach either end of the block before her pursuer arrived, she saw a truck parked at the back of a restaurant, the logo of a bakery emblazoned on its flank. Delivering bread or pastries or both, the driver wore a yellow rain slicker as he finished stacking 4 large rainproof plastic cases on a hand truck, which he rolled into the receiving room or kitchen of his customer. She darted to the driver's door, glancing into the cab through glass partly clouded by interior condensation, saw only that no one occupied it, and hurried to the back of the vehicle. She decided against the cargo area, where the driver had left one of the 2 doors ajar, most likely because he had more goods to offload. She boarded the front of the truck on the starboard side, pulling the cab's passenger door shut behind her, and she slid below window level, as far into the footwell as she could go. Rain streamed across the windshield, and the windows in both side doors were partially obscured by condensation. The interior cab light was off, the dashboard dark. As long as she stayed low, she probably would not be seen, unless her pursuer yanked open a door. But he was more likely to think she'd found an unlocked entrance to one of the businesses that backed up to the alley, most obviously the restaurant. As she tried to quiet her breathing, she heard sounds outside. She couldn't make much of them over the rataplan of rain. Then came the distinctive crackle of a voice transmitted on a walkie-talkie, the words not quite discernible. The man holding the walkie-talkie was close. Too close. He must have been standing beside the bakery truck. His voice was deep and muffled, but just clear enough.
half a block east of your position, behind some joint called Donatina's Restaurant.
The far voice crackled, and again Jane couldn't understand it.
All right,
said the nearer man.
You two in the front. Sweep the joint hard. Restrooms, everything. Driver to me.
His voice faded as he stepped away from the truck toward the back entrance of Donatina's. Jane thought of drawing her pistol, but curled in the footwell, with her back wedged between the seat and the passenger door, facing the steering wheel, she wouldn't be able to take a smart shot at anyone if it came to that. Anyway, they wouldn't give her a reason to shoot first. Whether they were remotely a legitimate authority of any kind or a totally rogue group, they would want to take her away for interrogation. They. Although she might not be able to name them now, she would know their identity one day. That was what she'd promised Nick, and even though it was a promise made after he was weeks in the grave, she would damn well keep it, as if it had been made to the living man, hold it as sacred as she had held their wedding vows. A couple of minutes passed before the driver opened the cargo box door that he had left ajar when he'd taken the first part of his delivery into the restaurant. The pass-through slider between the cab and the back of the truck had been left open. She heard the guy with the walkie-talkie, his voice no longer muffled, querying the driver.
You see a woman, brunette, 5'6", a looker, but half-drowned like me?
See her where?
Here, the alley. Maybe going in this joint?
When was this?
Since you got here.
I've been delivering.
So you haven't seen her?
In this shitty weather, wearing a hood, keeping my head down?
A different male voice entered the conversation.
The bitch is slick, Frank. She's somewhere else.
Frank said,
I've got a real hate on for the pig. Get in line. Who's this plastic banana?
The driver in his yellow rain gear said,
I've made deliveries here 5 years. Never saw what you'd call a looker.
To the new arrival, Frank said,
Bakery guy. He's got nothing.
What I've got is work to do in this shitty rain. What are you guys anyway, cops or something?
Better you don't know, Frank said.
Better I don't, said the driver,
and he began to offload more waterproof plastic boxes of baked goods. Jane waited, listened, expecting a face at a window, steam blurred and menacing like the face in a dream. Hard rain drumming the truck. No more lightning or thunder. Rain in California was seldom accompanied by extended pyrotechnics. Soon, the driver returned. She heard him lifting the dolly into the truck. He slammed the back door without speaking to anyone. Jane almost eeled up from the footwell to scramble out of the truck, but then she heard the tinny, static-speckled voice of someone on the walkie-talkie, which had been turned louder to compensate for poor reception. The driver's door opened, and the delivery man swung in behind the wheel before he startled at the sight of her.
Please, don't,
she whispered. Chapter 20. The driver was about Jane's age. His broad and pleasant face, sprayed with freckles and capped with rust-red eyebrows, suggested red hair under his bright yellow cowl. He pulled his door shut, started the engine, switched on the windshield wipers, and drove away from the restaurant. Before they reached the end of the block, he said,
All right, they're behind us. You can get up now.
I'd rather stay down here for a little ways. Then you can let me out, maybe at your next stop.
I could do that.
Thank you.
He braked at the end of the block.
But if there's somewhere in particular you want to go, I could also do that.
She considered him as he turned right into the street. What's your name?
Believe it or not, Ethan Hunt.
Why wouldn't I believe it?
Well, Ethan Hunt, like Tom Cruise in those Mission Impossible movies.
You get kidded about that, do you?
Not by anyone who knows the truth about bakery delivery. I disarm suitcase nukes and save the world about once a month.
Once a month, huh?
Well, every 6 weeks.
She liked his smile. There was neither snark nor megalomania in it, as characterized so many smiles these days. I need to get to my car. She told him where it was parked. But if you see any of those goons, drive right on by. She squirmed out of the footwell and sat upright in the passenger seat. Rain sheeted through the streets and gutters brimmed. The haloed headlights of approaching vehicles made the falling rain look like sleet and seemed to pave the blacktop with ice.
Probably I better not ask your name,
Ethan Hunt said. That might be safer for you.
Don't you believe in umbrellas?
She said. The drowned rat look is so becoming.
Any drowned rat looked half as good as you? I'd marry it.
Thanks, I think.
I'm taking a roundabout route just to be sure it's safe.
I figured that's what you were doing.
Plus, I want to keep this going a little while.
Been too long since a suitcase nuke, huh?
Seems forever. Those were some bad dudes back there.
Yes, I'm aware.
You sure you can handle them yourself?
Are you volunteering?
No way. They'd squash me like a bug. Just saying.
I'll be okay.
It'd make me sick to think you wouldn't.
He stopped beside her Ford Escape.
No goons in sight.
You're a sweet man, Ethan Hunt. Thank you.
Guess there's no way this could ever lead to a date.
Trust me, Ethan. I'd be the date from hell. She got out into the rain, and as she closed the door, she heard him say,
But you wouldn't be boring.
Chapter 21. Those who seemed to understand what lay behind the increase in suicides, who might even have engineered it, were clearly connected, root and branch, with as yet unidentified government agencies. Jane could only assume they would also have influence with authorities at the state level, including the California Highway Patrol. Leaving the city, she avoided freeways because that was where the CHP patrols could be found in the greatest numbers. There were choke points at which traffic could be easily halted or slowed for close inspection. The drones had transmitted video of her, and the men from whom she'd escaped in the foot chase had seen that her long blonde hair was now shorter and brown. A new description of her would already be in the hands of the searchers. She had meant to head up coast only a few miles to La Jolla to see a man that evening and put a question to him that, depending on his answer, might decide her future. Instead, she followed a series of rain-sluiced surface streets toward the coast, circled the town of La Jolla, and found her way to Torrey Pines State Reserve. There she connected with County Highway S-12. This coastal route served a number of picturesque beach cities, from Del Mar and Solana Beach north to Oceanside. At Torrey Pines State Beach, she drove into the parking lot, which was deserted in this weather. From under the passenger seat, she fished a small tool kit and took from it a screwdriver. She got out into the storm. The tall pines soughed. The driven rain danced on the pavement, raising from it a hissing like the threats of 1,000 angry serpents. Her wet fingers slipped on the screwdriver, but she managed to remove the front and rear license plates, all unobserved, as far as she could tell. If there had been traffic cameras near where she had left the car before walking to the library, as there were nearly everywhere in metropolitan areas these days, agents would soon be reviewing time-stamped video from all the streets that radiated away from the park where she had nearly been apprehended. Even with clarity diminished by the rain, they would hope to find video of her leaving the car and returning to it. She had to assume both that they knew she was driving a black Ford Escape and that it had Canadian plates. In California, a car without license plates didn't often excite police interest because dealerships didn't provide temporary plates for new purchases. Better that she proceed without tags than go cruising with a pair that might be on every cop's hot sheet within an hour or two. She put the plates under the driver's seat, got behind the wheel, and started the engine. Sopping wet again, she clicked the heater up a few degrees and accelerated the blower. When the wipers swept the blearing rain from the windshield, she saw the nearby Pacific, storm-lashed and misted, rolling toward shore less like water than like a sea of gray smoke pouring off the fires of some vast nuclear holocaust. Chapter 22. After stopping in Cardiff by the sea to refuel, she left the coastal highway for Interstate 5. She was more than 20 miles from the San Diego city limits, and the superhighway was worth the risk for the greater speed that it allowed. She drove out of the storm just north of Oceanside, where the coastal plain was flat and scrub-covered and forbidding in the hard, clear end-of-winter light. During the drive, with time to think, she decided that her first mistake had been to answer Gwen Lambert's question, "Where will you go from here?" She'd said she had someone to see near San Diego. The bond between Jane and Gwen had deserved her trust. Marine wives, marine widows. The three-strand bond of service, duty, and grief. She'd liked the woman. She'd had no reason to suspect that Gwen was somehow compromised and on an emotional precipice. Who had Gwen spoken to on the phone before killing herself? Why had she spoken to anyone? To tell him that Jane was headed next to San Diego? If they, the octopus-like they, had no agent near enough to apprehend her in Alpine, knowing her next destination narrowed their search parameters. But near San Diego encompassed perhaps 100 square miles and as many as 1.5 million people. Maybe that narrowed the search, but it certainly didn't pinpoint her whereabouts. In recent weeks, her pursuers had to have figured out that she was using library computers to do her internet searches. There were numerous libraries in the greater San Diego area, however, including many in colleges and universities. They might anticipate that she'd want to know more about the What If Conference and the Gernsback Institute after learning about them from Gwen. But to find her, they would have been required to mount a watch on those websites, with the capability of identifying, in real time, every query from a San Diego area library. They would then have needed to be able to immediately track to source the query and identify the unique signature of the workstation. If the searchers were closing in on her, even as she concluded her task in the branch library and as she gave $40 to the homeless veteran, her second mistake had been to dally in the park next door and make a phone call to Sydney Root in Chicago. If they knew every one of the 22 individuals from whom she'd gathered evidence to date, they might expect her to contact one or more of them again. Monitoring real-time phone traffic for that many people on multiple telecom platforms would be an enormous task, one that she wasn't even sure current technology allowed. Supposing all of that was possible, they would also have to trace her call, raveling backward through the microwave maze of millions of current calls to the particular transmissions from the disposable phone, and then somehow use that signal in a GPS search to locate her in the park. All within minutes. With only a few hours' notice from the time Gwyn had called them, they would have needed to place teams of agents at strategic points throughout the city, so if Jane's position was determined, at least one team had a chance of reaching her within minutes. Maybe they had been lucky, but in any case, lucky or not, the entity on her trail suddenly seemed ubiquitous, of greater power and reach than any one law enforcement organization, more efficient than any of the government agencies with which she was familiar, all but omnipresent and omniscient. Even if they had identified her vehicle, she would hope to use it for a while yet. Her financial resources were not unlimited, and this was her second set of wheels since this odyssey had begun. At San Juan Capistrano, she left Interstate 5 for State Highway 74. As the escape climbed the rugged chaparral-cloaked hills of the Cleveland National Forest, Jane's mood darkened faster than did the slowly waning day. Greener in this season than it would be later in the year, the borderline desert landscape was prized by hikers and nature enthusiasts, thought beautiful by some. To her, it appeared inhospitable, even bleak, as if beyond the windows of the Ford lay a stricken planet struggling under a dying sun. Descending then to Lake Elsinore and beyond, a rural world that seemed isolate, lush meadows and valley scrub, private graveled and oiled lanes leading to properties tucked back from the state route, small and separate groves of cottonwoods and conifers testifying to an aquifer under land that would have been otherwise hardscrabble. The remoteness was an illusion, because the hive of Southern California remained quickly accessible to the west, and even in this less bustling inland empire, small towns like Paris and Hemet boasted 70 or 80,000 residents each. She came to a private lane flanked by live oaks, turned right, and stopped at a plank gate painted white and infilled with wire. She put down her window and reached to the call box. She didn't need to announce herself. She had a personal 5-digit code that she entered on the keypad, and the gate swung open. Beyond lay, for her, the most important place in the world. Chapter 23. The white clapboard house was a modest residence, but for the luxury of a deep veranda that encircled it entirely. Duke and Queenie were lying on that porch, among the wicker chairs, and they sprang to their feet as the Ford reached the end of the long driveway. Two German shepherds, superb specimens with deep chests and well-sprung ribs and straight backs. They were both family pets and also guard dogs that had been well-trained. Jane pulled to a stop behind Gavin's prized apple-green 48 Ford pickup that he had chopped and channeled and sectioned himself, adding 37 LaSalle fenders and a highly customized LaSalle nose section with stainless steel grillwork, making it a street rod of singular style. The dogs knew her because she had left her driver's window down to ensure they caught her scent even before she got out of the Ford. They padded down the porch steps and sprinted to her, tails lashing the air in delight. Had she been a stranger, their approach would have been far different, circling and wary and full of menace. Dropping to one knee, She gave each dog its share of affection. They lavished their tongues on her hands, a friendly greeting that might have repelled some people, but that she received happily. They were guardians of her treasure, and she slept better knowing they were here. As much as she loved the dogs and admired the discipline that Gavin had instilled in them, she had not come here primarily to see them. After a minute, she rose to her feet and moved toward the house, the shepherds gambolling at her sides. With the fluid, springy step of a double amputee whose knee-down prosthetics ended in blade-like feet that allowed her to be a tough competitor in a 10K run, Jessica came through the front door and onto the veranda. Jet black hair, Cherokee complexion, blessed with beauty that came from the headwaters of her gene pool, she was, as always, a striking figure. She'd lost her legs 9 years earlier when she'd been 23, serving in Afghanistan. She'd been an Army non-combatant, but roadside IEDs didn't distinguish between armed troops and support services. Although she'd lost limbs in that godforsaken country, she found Gavin there, a combatant who had seen much hot action but had come through untouched. They had been married for 8 years. Jane bounded up the steps before Jess could spring down them, and they hugged fiercely there on the veranda, as around them the dogs whitted this way and that, whacking the wicker chairs with their tails, whimpering with pleasure at this unexpected reunion.
"Why didn't you call?" Jess asked.
"Tell you later."
She had three spare disposable phones, all activated. Each had been purchased from a different retailer in three widely separated towns. She had not yet used any of them. There was no way her pursuers could have a trace on them, but events in San Diego had so spooked her that she didn't want to risk calling this special place, this haven in a world that was otherwise increasingly a jungle of hazard and chaos.
"You look good," Jess said.
"You lie like a rug, girlfriend."
"He talks about you all the time."
"I think about him all the time."
"God, it's good to see you."
The boy stepped through the front door. His blue eyes shone with excitement, but he was shy, standing there in the shade of the veranda, at the moment indifferent to the dogs with which he usually frolicked. She had seen him only once before in the past 2 months, and on that occasion, as seemed to be the case now, he had been half afraid to speak or to hurry to her, fearful that she might evaporate as she did in his dreams. Only 5, Travis was already the image of his father. Nick's tousled hair, Nick's fine nose, strong chin. The intensity of his presence and the aura of intelligence that, at least to his mother, radiated from his eyes, were uncannily reminiscent of Nick. He whispered,
"It's really you."
Jane dropped to her knees, not merely to be at his level, but also because her legs suddenly grew weak and failed her. He came into her arms, and she held him as if someone might at any moment try to tear him from her. She couldn't stop touching him, kissing his face. The smell of his hair was intoxicating, the softness of his sweet young skin. When she had begun her search for the truth, she never imagined that she would find herself in conflict with people so powerful and merciless that the first threat they leveled at her would be to kill her only child. The only one she might ever have. This boy who was the living testament to the extraordinary love that she'd known with his special father. She knew of nowhere else where she might have hidden him with as much hope and peace of mind as she had felt when she'd brought him here. Jessica and Gavin had been strangers to him 2 months earlier, but they were family now. Passionate about clearing Nick's name, about proving that he had not committed suicide in any meaningful interpretation of the word, she had unknowingly set out on a path from which there could be no retreat. Those she sought to expose would not allow her to walk away and live, even in the deep humiliation of defeat. They had brought something new and terrible into the world. With what purpose, she still didn't understand. And they intended to see their plan, whatever it might be, fulfilled at any cost. There was already much murder in it. Two more killings, a mother and her son, would be to them not even so much as an inconvenience. She knew little, but she knew too much, and she suspected more. And there would be no one to whom she could risk turning for help until she knew it all. The boy held fast to her.
"I love you, Mom,"
she said. "I love you too. So much. You rock me, kid." Part 2. Rabbit Hole. Chapter 1. In the golden light of late afternoon, under scattered white clouds with gilded edges, Travis took his mother to visit the horses. The stable stood in the deep shade of live oaks that shed their small, oval leaves all year. The surrounding ground was raked clean a few times a week. The swirls of parallel lines scored into the soft soil by the tines of the leaf rake resembled patterns that certain ancient shamans carved in stone to represent the mysterious turnings of fate, the endless cycles of a universe inscrutable in spite of its apparent design. Bella and Samson, mare and stallion, were housed side by side, facing two empty stalls, one of which had been fitted with a lower door to accommodate a pony not yet in residence. The horses craned their necks over their stall doors to watch their visitors approach and nickered in welcome. In a paper cup, Travis carried a quartered apple, two pieces for each horse. With their soft lips, the animals finessed the treats from his small fingers. He said,
"Gavin hasn't found the right pony yet."
A month earlier, Jane had approved her son's desire to learn to ride and Gavin's preference that the child begin with a small mount.
"I couldn't ride Samson yet, but I'm pretty sure I could ride Bella if you guys would let me. She's real gentle."
"And like 15 times your size. Anyway, Samson might be jealous if anyone but Jess rode her. He's the only guy for Bella."
"Do horses get jealous?"
"Oh, they do. Like Duke and Queenie get jealous if you pet the one a lot more than the other. Horses and dogs have shared their lives with people so long, they've come to have some of the same feelings we do." Bella lowered her head so far over the half door that Travis could reach high enough to stroke her cheeks, a ministration for which she had a special fondness.
"But I bet I could ride Bella if it was okay with Samson."
"Maybe you could, cowboy. But nobody becomes a master horseman if he's not patient and willing to learn one step at a time."
"Master horseman. That would be too cool."
"Your dad was raised on a ranch, did some rodeo by the time he was 17. It's in your blood. But so is common sense. So you be a good boy and listen to your common sense."
"I will."
"I know you will." She smoothed one hand along Samson's muscular neck, along that indentation called the jugular groove, and felt the power of his pulse against her palm. The boy said,
"Are you still looking for the killer?"
"Yes. Every day." She hadn't told him that his father committed suicide, and she never would. Anyone who ever repeated that lie to Travis would earn her enmity forever.
Is it scary?
He asked. Not scary, she lied. And then some truth. A little dangerous, sometimes.
But you know, I've been doing this for years, and never even stubbed a toe.
When not on leave, she provided investigation support for behavioral analysis units 3 and 4, specifically dealing with mass murderers and serial killers.
Not even a toe?
Not even.
'Cause you have common sense, huh?
That's right. Sampson fixed her with his limpid, liquid gaze. Not for the first time, Jane felt that horses, like dogs, with their heightened 5 senses, or even with a 6th, could read people far better than people could read them. In the stallion's dark and steady stare, there seemed to be an awareness of the fear she'd denied, and of her double grief at the loss of a husband and the necessary separation from this child. Chapter 2. After dinner, after a play session in the early dark with a glowing frisbee and the 2 dogs, after Jane read to Travis from the storybook that Jessica had started 3 days earlier, after he fell asleep, and after she stood over him for some time, enchanted by his face, in which she saw both Nick and herself, she went to the family room off the kitchen. Jess and Gavin sat in armchairs, and the dogs dozed near the hearth. The only light issued from the fireplace, in which logs crackled and popped and flared briefly each time the flames opened a new vein of sap. There was an armchair for her, a glass of Cabernet on the small table beside it. She was grateful for both. The TV was off, and the music somewhat surprised Jane. Windham Hill did not seem to be a genre first in the heart of either Gavin or Jess. This was an anthology album featuring Liz Story and George Winston piano solos, Will Ackerman solos on acoustic guitar. The elegant simplicity of the music worked a peace upon the room as surely as did the fireplace. She realized why only the firelight, why the music, when the first thing she thought to say after sipping her wine was, "What's the latest from Philadelphia?"
340 confirmed dead, Gavin said.
Jess said, "It'll go 100 higher, maybe more. And so many injured, burned, disfigured." Gavin sat with one hand fisted on the arm of his chair, the other around a wine glass.
"It's all over the TV. If you try to watch anything else, you feel like you've lost your humanity."
"Damn if we'll watch it," Jess said. "It's not tragedy, the way they report it, not horror, certainly not war reporting. It's all spectacle, and once you let yourself see it that way, your soul begins to turn to dust." Chapter 3. She and Nick had met Gavin and Jessica Washington 14 months earlier, at a weekend-long fundraiser for Wounded Warriors in Virginia. Competing in the 5K race, not in a division for those with disabilities, but among the whole-body athletes, Jess's time was less than a minute longer than Jane took to cross the finish line. The 4 of them had recognized kindred spirits without long discussions about the state of the world, merely from nuances of speech and gesture and facial expressions, as much from things not said as from things said. They had spent time together at a 2nd event 4 months later, and it was as if they had been friends from childhood. Their ease with one another seemed like that of close siblings. Gavin earned a living writing military nonfiction, and more recently a series of novels with a cast of Special Forces ops. He hadn't enjoyed a bestseller yet, but he had a mainstream publisher and a growing reputation that surprised him, considering that he'd fallen into writing rather than planning his career. Working as a busy volunteer for veterans' causes, Jess proved to have keen organizational skills and a knack for getting others to donate time and money without guilting them. Of the qualities Jane liked about Gavin, his devotion to Jess spoke most highly of him. Many guys would have professed love for Jess until her legs were gone from the knees down, then would have vanished as if they were nothing more than ghostly manifestations of men. Gavin had never known her without prosthetics, which he seemed to regard as no more disabling than a need for reading glasses. As one who had turned a few heads in her time, Jane had seen desires in men's eyes that they didn't hope to fulfill, but that they couldn't conceal. When Gavin looked at her, however, he might have been a monk or a brother of the more conventional kind, for there was no quickening in him, no desire for more than friendship. She and Nick had planned to meet the Washingtons for a 3-day weekend in Vegas in early December, but Nick hadn't lived that long. By mid-January, Jane's insistent denial that her husband's death was what it appeared to be, her inquiries into other peculiar suicides, and her research brought her to the attention of people who regarded her with pure, venomous contempt. Nameless, faceless, they delivered such a convincing threat against Travis that even if she obeyed them and gave up her investigation, she knew that she and the boy would remain at risk. Besides, she would not bend to them. Not then, not ever. Travis would not have been safe with family or with friends of long acquaintance. If the wrong people had wanted to find him, he would have been found in short order. Jess and Gavin Washington did not live off the grid, but they weren't given to swimming in social media. Like Jane and Nick, they didn't have a Facebook page or a Twitter account, perhaps because the experienced warrior in all of them intuitively recognized the danger in throwing off camouflage to strut in sunlight. An online search wouldn't link their names. Their friendship was conducted face-to-face by snail mail letters that didn't leave the indelible history of text messaging, and by telephone. Even if someone scanned phone records, the number of calls between them wasn't sufficient to raise a suspicion that their relationship might be deep enough for Jane to entrust her son to them. Once she realized that her days of living an above-ground life were behind her, she'd gotten her first car without GPS, an ancient Chevy purchased off a used car lot, not yet a stolen vehicle repurposed and souped up in Mexico. With Travis, she'd driven cross-country from Virginia to California, employing her law enforcement training to be sure they were never tailed and that they left no trail to follow, paying cash and keeping a low profile. She had not called ahead to the Washingtons, neither from a payphone nor with a disposable cell, telling herself that even such a tenuous lead was too much to risk, though in fact, her true fear was that Jess and Gavin would decline to take responsibility for Travis. In that case, she would be at a cliff's edge without options. They hadn't refused. Indeed, they agreed without hesitation. In her heart, Jane knew that she had always read them right and that they could be depended on in a crisis. Yet their willingness had moved her to tears. Though, in the days following Nick's funeral, she had sworn off tears, had forbid herself all expressions of doubt and weakness until she'd brought this business to an end. Leaving the boy in California had cleaved her. When not in his company, she felt as if an essential limb was missing. In Virginia again, she sold the house, liquidated investments, and salted the money where only she could draw on it. Her enemies seemed to have interpreted her hiatus from the investigation as abject surrender. When they realized she was on their trail again, they sought her relentlessly. Chapter 4. To the music of Windham Hill and the snoring of contented dogs in firelight, 2 hours passed, with wine and conversation, but with no further talk of Philadelphia, before she returned to Travis's room for the night. Jessica wanted to make up the bed in the spare room, but Jane couldn't abide that distance from the boy, for she would too soon be on the road again, alone. She didn't want to wake him by joining him on the bed. She sat in an armchair, legs propped on a footstool, wrapped in a blanket, watching him sleep in the low lamplight. She had nothing to live for now, except vengeance and this precious boy. She would revel in the vengeance, but if she died for either cause, the only good death would be to die for him. For a while, she couldn't sleep because she remembered. Chapter 5. She is at home, that day in January, at her computer, collecting yet more stories of unlikely suicides from local newspapers coast to coast, because many of the strangest deaths have not been reported by the national media. Travis is in his room, building with his Lego blocks. He has not been much interested in play since Nick's death, and his recent obsession with building Lego forts is either a first step back toward a normal childhood or a quiet expression of his fear and his sense of being defenseless in a world that took his father from him. Appearing in the doorway of her study, bright-eyed and earnest, Travis says,
"Mommy, what does it mean?"
She turns from her computer. "What does what mean?"
"Natsat. What does it mean?"
"Well, I guess it means that somebody named Nat sat down on something." Giggling, he races away, footsteps pounding along the hall to his room. Jane is mystified, but also charmed and hopeful, because this is the first she's heard him laugh in weeks. A minute later, he returns.
"No, that's wrong. Natsat is one word. Can I have some milk plus?"
"Milk plus what, kiddo?"
"I don't know. Wait, I'll find out."
Giggling as before, he runs to his room once more. Natsat. Milk plus. Jane's mind is busy with the details of unlikely suicides, puzzled by the disturbing and cryptic notes left by some of those who took their own lives. But slowly, a memory rises from a time that now seems as long gone as Caesar's Rome, from her college years. She is getting up from her office chair when the boy appears once more, his enthusiasm in full bloom.
"Mr. Droog says you know what Milk Plus is."
Yes. She remembers now. 19, and in her last year of an accelerated college schedule, she is impressed by Anthony Burgess's novel, A Clockwork Orange. The story is of a future society rapidly descending into disorder and brutal violence, and it influences her toward a career in law enforcement. In the book, Natsat is a dialect spoken by young British thugs, cobbled together from Romani and Russian and baby talk, spoken with gypsy rhythms. Milk bars serve milk with a variety of drugs. The drug-crazed, ultra-violent thugs call themselves droogs. By the time she rises from the chair in her study, Jane is fully alarmed. In the doorway, Travis stands in a state of innocent delight, unaware that his next words spawn in her a shrinking, anxious dread.
"Mr. Droog says me and him will have some milk plus and then play a really fun game called rape."
"Honey,